Thank you, Ramo. Thank you, everyone, for coming. So I know there's limited time, so I'm going to be rushing. I have a lot of... So the catch word is in psychrometry. So what? Satellite psychrometry. So hopefully I can convince you that we can apply the wet bulb, dry bulb. So some of it's not new. I'd like to acknowledge people I work with, team members, researchers, GIS analysts. So I'm going to give you a quick summary and what is satellite psychrometry. I'm going to show you some case studies of how this is being applied at regional scale. I hope nobody's in a hurry to leave, but if you have to leave, I'm going to say, well, we use land surface temperature and the principle of psychrometry to generate ET maps regularly, not only for regions, but for the whole world, actually. Application for drought monitoring in terms of relative change is reliable. You can use it as is. It's on the website. When it comes to absolute magnitude, then you better, you know, find good data and validate, because there will be bias. This is satellite data. We trust its consistency, but there could be bias. Okay, this is an ET community. There's nothing to go. Just I would like to say ET is the most difficult component of the water budget. Of course, you know, if we monitor ET, you can do a lot of things in here. So how does this work? Well, there is a potential ET component in here on the left. There's limitations. The satellite data is going to help us on the limitations. So soil moisture, vegetation condition, environmental stress, the land surface temperature is going to give us. So at the bottom here, actually, is data from Arizona. As you can see, the green line is the one, the potential ET. So we get the potential ET from Priestley Taylor or from Panman Montes. So we don't do anything. We just take that data. But the satellite data is going to give us that fraction of it, actually, in the bottom, the fraction of it as a fraction of the potential using a psychrometric approach. We know the landscapes are at different levels of stress, so we cannot use potentiality all the time. There has been publications in how we can come up with stress coefficients, soil moisture, or plant condition. But now what I'm saying is these coefficients, the two coefficients, can be combined in the land surface temperature from satellite. So we use this method in an energy balance approach, but simplified for the US and for the globe. And the kind of product we produce is, as you would say, is annual ET, you know, where high ET is expected in the southeast, also irrigated valley of central valley, works, seems to work. Then I'm going to show you how does this work. These are the basic principles. So we use radiation emitted from the Earth. So that's captured by satellite. So that's how land surface temperature is acquired. And evaporative cooling, you know, it lowers the temperature. That's the basic principle. Bill also showed that there is a huge temperature difference between a bare ground that's not transpiring and versus the one evaporating surface. So the model is so simple, it's called simplified surface energy balance. The weather data gives us the Panman Montes, the potentiality. What we do, we spend time, is really coming up with this ET fraction 0 to 1. Simple, but at the bottom I say it's not necessarily easy. It's a hot and cold principle, a Sebald metric, but how do you do this everywhere for the globe? So that makes it difficult. So I'm going to talk about the psychrometric principle. So hot bulb and dry bulb principles. This is used for measuring relative humidity. I have got my own sling psychrometer. So if I could get it here. So there's a wet bulb and dry bulb. So, and they do this for 1 minute, and there will be an equilibrium position. You can have a look at it. There are two temperatures in here, thermometers. So the drier the air, you know, the higher evaporative capacity. And the temperature difference, the ambient temperature and the wet bulb will be big. So that's the main difference, the main of the principle. Why don't we apply this now from satellite data? So it's pretty much like similar to thermocouple psychrometry. So it's not really new. And plant scientists and soil scientists have used thermocouple psychrometry to determine, you know, soil water potential of plant leaves. The only thing is I'm applying this to satellite data. So satellite psychrometry, well, instead of using electrical circuits, you use satellite data. So temperature is measured from satellites. The dry bulb and wet bulb, where do you get that? The dry bulb is actually the ambient temperature. Any pixel, it would be the dry bulb equivalent. So now how do you get the wet bulb? That would be the coldest kind of image that would act as a reference. Now, how do you get that well-built with built next to a dry bulb? So that's really where we spend time. So imagine a satellite image, what you get. So you can get really wet bulb, dry bulb. So they're going to be dry bulb. Every pixel image will be a dry bulb, so ambient. But you got to find a wet bulb somewhere close by. How sure are you getting that wet bulb? Well, you may not get wet bulb everywhere, but what we found out is actually we can use air temperature as a substitute for a wet bulb with some calibrations. Then once you have air temperature as your wet bulb, the equation becomes really simple. So surface temperature ambient, any pixel, to a cold temperature driven on air temperature, and then you can have to come up with a psychrometric constant, which is equivalent to the standard psychrometric constant. And that constant is pretty much a function of physical variables you are familiar with. So with this, you have, for relative humidity, the usual dry bulb, wet bulb, the difference in temperature, it tells you the actual vapor pressure. The saturation vapor pressure could be obtained from the wet bulb temperature. Again, this constant is a function of pressure, location only, for relative humidity. Now what we're saying is, well, I'm going to formulate the same way, so now I have to come up with a new constant for the surface. Again, it's just pretty much a function of really physical parameters you can derive for a location. So I'm going to show you an example how it works. This is a transect in lower Colorado River Basin. We're going from, you know, from point A to point C, going through mountains and irrigation fields on B. So this is the land surface temperature distribution. This is the equation I'm showing you. If you look at in here, the one in the middle is the land surface temperature that's derived from satellite data. And as you can see how variable it is, as you go across irrigation fields on round B, the temperature comes down. As Bill Kustas was showing, the temperature difference between really the air temperature at the bottom or from the air temperature is huge. It could be as high as 20 degrees centigrade or plus. As you can see, the air temperature in here is a kind of regional variable. It doesn't vary that much, you know, at close locations. But then where do you get that constant, dT? That's pretty much the psychrometric constant I can predefine for any location for a given day anywhere in the world, because really most of it driven by net radiation on a clear sky condition. So the ET we derive is this, and the potentiality is a fraction of that. Again, potentiality is also kind of a regional variable. It doesn't vary that much at close proximity. What you see in here is a vegetation index for the same. So as you would imagine, irrigated fields will have higher NDVI and then corresponding higher ET. Potentiality, as I said, is a regional variable, but it varies, you know. In the mountains would be much lower than in the valleys in here, and there could be as high as a 40% difference in potentiality within the basin, for example. Where do you get the data? Most of you are familiar with this. You can use Landsat for land surface temperature, 100 meter, MODIS 1 kilometer, and air temperature, depending where you are. For the world, we use WorldClim. In the US, we have PRISM, DAMET, and stuff. And the reference city, you can use Priestley-Taylor or Penman-Montes. It's a gridded surface, again, depending on available data for you. This is an example of a MODIS land surface temperature, 8-day average. This is the Penman-Montes solution we solve every day at EROS for the world using daily data. So I'm going to show an example now how we apply this for the whole Colorado River Basin. It takes about 500 images to run the whole Colorado River Basin for a season. At the MODIS scale, the model, and the Landsat scale, very similar at this scale. But when you zoom in, that difference comes in. Again, these are seasonal totals. You can see center pivots higher ET and MODIS. But the hope is, you know, you average this and you average this, you get comparable results. So at a higher scale, you should get similar results. But if you are interested in farmers' fields, then you have to use Landsat. So this is really a scale issue. Again, this is irrigated areas, and you can see center pivots compared to the background rain-fed system, a huge ET difference. Again, that's no brainer, just the whole thing is to show the method seems to work everywhere. These are seasonal values from Landsat again. Evaluation also using flux towers. This is an example we applied in the Palo Verde in California. what shows you seasonal total ET in the 90s, 2000, 2010, what happens is a much lower ET, and that's because of the following program, the water is being diverted and going to Los Angeles, city of Los Angeles. So again, seems to work, and now you can run this historically using Landsat from 1984, and this is seasonal total ET. And then when you plot this total ET from 1984 to 2014, you can see the following program, and there are different ETs. One is from Bureau of Reclamation, from their water budget instrumentation. This is model, the blue is model. So it seems to capture also the year-to-year variability at a basin scale again. We have also used flex towers to evaluate this. There is some good, really, performance, but I think the model looks really too good in here. The reason is we used really local data at the flex towers for the air temperature, so we got better results. So it doesn't look like this everywhere. For water budget analysis, I'm going to show you this is a rainfall distribution, for example, the upper Mississippi River. What I'm trying to show is ET gives you much higher spatial variability compared to rainfall as expected because it's a function of land cover as well. And how does it close the water budget at the basin scale? Actually, it closes the budget within plus or minus 5%. This is ET precipitation, and this is ET, this is runoff from USGS. So generally, it's capturing the annual water budget as well. It just gives you a good sense of how much is the bias. In this case, it seems to be working fine. This is month-to-month variability for the same basin. Rainfall peaks in May, runoff peaks in April. But for the same amount of rainfall, for example, in April and July, the runoff is much lower because, of course, ET is much higher. So at least it helps you also understand the water budget kind of distribution. We use this model for drought monitoring purposes. For example, this is on the website. It shows you April to October for this year, drought conditions in part of Wyoming. The negative values are in here, green is above normal. This is the previous year, 2015, drought in the Northwest, 2014, 2012, drought again. It's a simple model. The nice thing about simple model is it's consistent, so it's really, you can trust the model from year to year variability. These are different years. I guess this is pretty much what I want to show you, say. It's a physically based model. It's very simple. It follows the psychrometric principle. The anomaly is good for operational drought monitoring, but again, for magnitude, at least you have to bias correct so that we remove the bias. So that's all I have. I appreciate it. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to take.
Questions?
Yes, Bill. That's a challenge. Most of the one I show global is really in our modus, but Landsat, the one I showed you most of in the southwest, where there is good, at least we get once a month in the southwest, cloud is not that much of a problem. Otherwise, it's really a challenge to do Landsat for a globe. So, yeah, it's all interpolation based on the potentiality, because we have daily potentiality, and we assume the ET fraction stays the same. But if you go more than a month, really that assumption breaks down. But modus is a daily data, as you know. That's seasonal interpolation is a challenge.
What about mountainous regions? We find that's a difficult place to estimate ET because you get such variation with altitude, with temperature, and you also get sun angle, topographic effects.
Yeah, that's correct. So again, we rely on the air temperature as our lower boundary condition. So if the air temperature, whoever produces the air temperature is good, then that gives our lower boundary condition. We are kind of protected by a good air temperature data. But if the air temperature data is bad, then we are in a big problem. Yeah. So we don't solve the whole energy balance. We really borrow, we leverage the air temperature. If that air temperature data is good, it's decent, yes, but it's still a challenge. One of the challenges we get is the assumption is the air temperature and the land surface temperature lapse rate is comparable. But we found out it's not comparable, especially really high mountains or special isolated mountains. And then, yeah. But generally, the air temperature helps us. But most of these peak mountains, anyways, their ET is very low and they are not that important from ET point of view. We are more interested in irrigated areas for most of the time.